This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
This is Dr. Hal Schurz on America's Web Radio. Let me welcome you into the Doctor's Lounge. Every hospital has a place where doctors congregate to discuss problems and issues in healthcare that affect them and affect all of you. In the Doctor's Lounge, we'll let you in on some of these private conversations. You'll get the inside scoop on topics like Obamacare and all the problems that have resulted because of it. You'll hear about solutions to the healthcare problems, and mostly we'll try to educate you and give you ammunition that you need to allow you to fight for your healthcare freedom. The Doctor's Lounge comes to you live every Thursday morning at 8 a.m. Eastern Standard Time from Atlanta, and the shows are archived on the website, so if you can't listen to them live in their entirety, do so by going online and clicking on the Doctor's Lounge on www.americaswebradio.com. Our previous shows have gotten a lot of positive feedback, and we've talked about the VA scandal, we've talked about free market health care solutions and direct primary care. And last week, my co-host, Dr. Mike Karuchik, discussed the electronic medical record boondoggle and how and why we're required to use electronic medical records now. The Doctor's Lounge is sponsored by the Docs for Patient Care Foundation, which is a non-for-profit tax-exempt organization that I hope everyone will support, and we'll let you in on how to do that in the coming weeks. The goal of our foundation is to fight to preserve the doctor-patient relationship and fight for healthcare freedom for all Americans. And again, I hope that everybody will become a part of this this effort and this organization and support it. Today, we're going to talk about the dysfunctional medical malpractice system and why this is important to every American. It really affects us all in so many ways, but what most people don't realize is the way that doctors react to the threat of getting sued is to order more tests, to be certain that they don't overlook something, even though the likelihood of finding something might be infinitesimally small. And this is what's called the practice of defensive medicine. We'll get into that. But I think it's important to bring up right at the beginning because defensive medicine is probably one of the biggest drivers of the out-of-control healthcare system. Some conservative estimates put defensive medicine costs in the $250 billion range annually. That's billion with a B. And some other estimates price it as much as $600 billion. And when you think about the cost of healthcare in this country annually being about $2.5 to $2.7 trillion, we're talking about a quarter of the costs can be accounted for by defensive medicine. And this is something that needs to be addressed, but the cost of doing nothing might be even greater than the cost of defensive medicine. So today I would like to join me in the Doctor's Lounge, my good friend Jeff Siegel, who is an expert on this subject. Dr. Siegel is a board-certified neurosurgeon who trained at Baylor College of Medicine. And then he went on to become an attorney and graduated from the Concord Law School with highest honors. In 2002, he launched an organization called Medical Justice, which is a physician-based organization that focuses on keeping doctors from being sued for frivolous reasons. It also protects doctors from their reputations being besmirched, and this is a particularly difficult problem with the online assault to reputations. He has established himself as one of the country's leading authorities on medical malpractice and online reputation. And one of the things that we're going to get into today is his involvement in an effort that started here in Atlanta with a organization called Patients for Fair Compensation, which is a nonprofit organization that is trying to fix our broken malpractice system with an entirely new system that would provide timely, predictable compensation to patients who are injured. So I'd like to welcome you, Jeff, into the Doctor's Lounge.
Hey, thanks so much for having me join the conversation. Pleasure to be in the Doctor's Lounge.
So, Jeff, tell me why somebody who is a successful, accomplished neurosurgeon would want to go ahead and become a lawyer?
Yeah, well, that's something my parents asked me early on because years later, they're still scratching their heads. But here's what happened. I was perfectly happy practicing as a neurosurgeon. I was practicing in a tort reform state, Indiana. What that means is that the laws were mostly doctor-friendly. I operated on a patient who had fallen off of a horse after drinking a six-pack. He was brought to a local community hospital with a neck fracture, but moving arms and legs and otherwise neurologically intact. He was then transferred to the town, the hospital where I was working, and I was on call. So I came in to see him. I saw that he had a fractured spine. I took him to the operating room, put him back together, put Humpty Dumpty back together again, and he was discharged from the hospital the next day entirely intact. I had, over the following year, moved to another state, but not too long after that, I was served with a lawsuit, the allegation being that somehow I had injured this person. Now, remember, this person was neurologically intact when he came in. He was neurologically intact when he left, so I was really scratching my head. What fueled this entire process was an expert witness who said that I had violated a number of standards of care. I had fallen below my duty, and because of that, I had permanently injured my patient. Now, the person who was propelling this lawsuit as an expert witness, every case needs an expert, was a neurosurgeon who had been expelled from our professional medical society, the American Association of Neurological Surgeons, precisely for delivering frivolous testimony, for delivering junk testimony. Yet there he was, you know, opining how I was the worst doctor on the planet. Now, the case was dismissed about 2 weeks before trial, but I never felt as if I won anything. I only felt as if I lost less. So that became a real motivator for me to try and prevent other doctors from experiencing what I experienced. It was a long odyssey that was particularly unpleasant, and it was also preventable. So we put together an organization called Medical Justice, an entity designed to keep doctors from being sued for frivolous reasons, and we do so by holding proponents of these suits accountable in a number of different venues. Along the way, I thought, since I'm kind of shoulder deep in the legal system, it might be helpful to understand the law a bit better, so I did get a law degree. So that's a very long-winded way to describe the long and winding road.
Jeff, what percentage of doctors do you think get sued in their career?
All right, so this is a question that we know the answer to. A study was performed in the New England Journal of Medicine, and it was published within the past couple of years, and it looked at doctors across the U.S. in different specialties. So if you're in a low-risk specialty, okay, if you're in a low-risk specialty, the likelihood of being sued at least once over the course of your career is 75%. So if you're in a low-risk specialty, the likelihood of being sued at least one time in your career and experiencing the type of drama that I just described to you is 75%. Now, let's move to high-risk specialty. I'm a neurosurgeon. Virtually every surgical subspecialty would be considered high risk. And those numbers are even higher. So the likelihood of being sued at least one time during the course of your career would be 99%. So if you are in a surgical subspecialty, it is almost certain that you will be sued at least once in your career, and the average lawsuit takes about 3 to 5 years to percolate through the system till you get resolution.
Wow. And most of these suits they have merit, correct?
Well, actually, most of these suits don't have merit. If we describe merit as something that ends up with a payment, settlement, or judgment in favor of the plaintiff, we have pretty good statistics on that. It turns out that most cases are ruled in favor of the physician. That means the case is either dropped or if the case goes to trial, and not many cases do go to trial, but if the case does go to trial, the doctor prevails probably 80 to 90% of the time. So here you have a system that takes 3 to 5 years to get to resolution, and at the end of the day, most of the patients who propel these claims actually end up empty-handed. Now, the thing that's also interesting is that because of the way the system is set up, many patients who have bona fide legitimate claims actually are not able to get a lawyer to take their case for a number of reasons. So the system actually discriminates in both directions. It targets doctors who probably should never have been sued in the first place, and it also does not provide a remedy for many patients who otherwise have a legitimate case. There was, I think someone put it aptly when they said, it's similar to a traffic cop giving out tickets for people going through a green light, but not giving a ticket for anyone going through a red light.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. So, you've given just startling statistics about the risk of a doctor getting sued. Tell our listeners what the direct costs to the doctors are in terms of malpractice insurance. What it costs a doctor in different specialties to just get basic coverage so that they don't suffer personal bankruptcy from being sued.
All right. So the cost to just purchase insurance and nothing other than purchasing an insurance policy that will pay for an attorney and or settlement or judgment up to a limit varies depending upon where you live and what your specialty is. So, for example, the best, rosiest case scenario would be maybe a family practitioner in the Midwest who may pay anywhere from $5,000 to $6,000 or $7,000 a year. That would be the rosiest situation. The more challenging situation would be for a neurosurgeon in Long Island, New York, or Broward or Dade County in Florida, where he or she may end up paying $250,000 a year.
Wow.
$250,000 a year. Now, what is even more interesting is that in Florida, well, let me back up a second. The average insurance policy will pay out $1 million for a settlement or judgment. So in New York, you're paying $250,000 for $1 million worth of coverage. In Florida, the average or the policy that you're purchasing is $250,000. So you're paying $250,000 to get $250,000 in coverage. So you might ask, well, why would anyone do that? And the answer is, well, if you're sued more than one time in any given year, you'll get coverage for up to three cases. So you actually get coverage for $250,000 three times. So the point is that these are not insignificant sums, and if you practice in a surgical subspecialty where you are likely to get sued, the price for just covering yourself and trying to keep your assets safe is quite steep.
Wow. Well, we're coming up to a hard break in just a few seconds. So we're going to talk a little bit more about these predatory practices that are happening with medical malpractice in a few minutes, and maybe get a little bit more into some specifics and let our listeners in on what the experience might be for doctors and what some possible solutions to this problem are. You're in the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
Come on, follow Sniffles to Atlanta's go-to center for breathing easy. Do you suffer from chronic sinus headaches, recurrent sinusitis, facial pain or pressure, and chronic congestion? Well, balloon sinuplasty just could be the cure you're looking for.
Follow me and breathe easy. FollowSniffles.com. We treat the problem, not the symptom. Chronic sinus symptoms, gone. This could be the cure you're looking for.
Follow me and breathe easy.
This proven in-office procedure can have you breathing easy, back to work the next day, and it's done under local anesthesia. Get lasting relief, a quick recovery, and start breathing easy again.
Follow me and breathe easy.
FollowSniffles.com.
With all the back and forth in today's politics, it seems as though the Constitution gets lost in the mix. If you want to brush up on your Constitution, then join Michael Conley every Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. for the show Our Constitution on AmericasWebRadio.com.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
This is Dr. Susan Blank, Medical Director for the Atlanta Healing Center. Our team is able to offer a multitude of treatment options, such as quantitative EEG, also known as brain mapping, hormonal and nutritional assessments, neuropsychological testing, and cognitive therapy, along with traditional 12-step facilitation. And we can even offer you, if appropriate, a gentle medically managed detox. Please contact us at 770-696-9862.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Burn the crap out of
Welcome back to the Doctor's Lounge. If you have any comments about today's show or any thoughts about future shows or just any feedback at all, please share them with us at Doctor's Lounge at AmericasWebRadio.com, and I'd love to hear what you have to say. Coming back to my guest today, Dr. Jeff Siegel, who is a neurosurgeon turned lawyer who has devoted his career to helping doctors who are victimized by predatory lawyers, a lawyer helping doctors. That's an incredible turnaround. And we've been discussing how bad medical malpractice is in the country right now and the high costs of it. You know, Jeff, in some specialties, there are there are no doctors in some areas in certain specialties because of the high costs of malpractice or the fact that they've been driven out by predatory lawyers who are ambulance chasers or trying to make cases where they don't exist. One of the best examples, I guess, would be former Senator, former presidential candidate John Edwards, who made a career out of destroying obstetricians.
Yes, believe it or not, John Edwards is back. I just saw a note a few weeks ago that he is trying cases, and we published a blog post which said that John Edwards just pocketed $4 million on a recent case in Virginia/North Carolina. So yes, he's back. Look, I want to follow up on that issue because that's an important one, namely the access to care issue. If the environment becomes so unconducive to areas that are already poorly served, the doctors often will leave and go to more favorable climates. So a good friend of mine who I trained with was practicing neurosurgery in an underserved area. This would have been Carbondale, Illinois, southern Illinois, and they did it all. They took care of elective spine cases, but they also addressed trauma, in particular head trauma. And he and his partner were the only two people in the region that were addressing that. They kept getting sued left and right from a set of attorneys in a judicial hellhole area. And finally, they both said they had had enough. They left. One went to South Carolina. The other one moved to Wichita, Kansas. So that region was without a neurosurgeon for some period of time. Now, so what happens if someone puts their head through a windshield? Well, they would naturally be transferred to the closest trauma facility. And for certainly some cases, that would be Chicago. Well, how do you get there? Well, you get there quickly with a helicopter. But remember, helicopters don't fly if the weather's bad. So if you, at one point, if you were going to have a car accident where your head went through a windshield, you should be praying for good weather. So this really does turn into an access to care issue. It's not just about the doctors. It really is also about the patient.
And this is why patients should be concerned about medical malpractice, isn't it?
Patients have a lot of skin in the game. It is all about access to care. If an environment becomes onerous to a particular specialty, patients or the doctors will go elsewhere, and that means the patients have to travel further and further. At one point in Texas, this would have been over a decade ago, the environment was so horrible, there were many counties in Texas. Texas is, of course, a big state, but there were many counties that did not have an obstetrician. So if you were pregnant and ready to deliver, you really needed to plan ahead because there really was no one who could deliver your baby. Not an obstetrician, not a family practitioner who had the background training and experience to deliver a baby. You needed to go 70, 100, 200 miles to find someone to deliver your baby. Now, the laws were changed in Texas. It became a much more favorable climate because of substantive tort reforms. And so what happened? Well, access to care became less of a problem. It became a favorable climate for doctors to practice. And so more and more doctors were filling out applications for state licensure in Texas.
And
it
actually,
is a patient issue.
And Texas is one of the states that, if not the, it's the state that has the largest influx of doctors in the country. And I think that in large part, tort reform in Texas is largely responsible for that.
I think there's no doubt that when the environment changed, as to the tort climate, it became much more inviting for physicians to come take a look and then to fill out the application for licensure. In fact, there were so many applications being filled out, the Board of Medicine didn't have the infrastructure to handle the influx. And so the reason doctors were complaining was because it was taking so long to process their applications. This is a good problem to have. It's not a bad problem.
It is a good problem. And another aspect of that is it not only affects patients directly, but it also affects the states and businesses. Businesses are more likely to relocate to states where there's adequate health care. But if there's a shortage of health care providers like obstetricians or neurosurgeons, a business that's thinking about relocating their factory, relocating their headquarters, might think twice about going to a state like New York versus a state like Texas.
There's no doubt that businesses do think about issues like health care. What will their health care costs be like? If they're looking to attract employees from areas that have a lot of talent, how do they do that? And one way they do it is by, you know, taking a look at the environment and seeing what is the healthcare climate like. Is it likely that my employers will be happy in terms of the healthcare delivery system, or are they going to struggle? If they struggle, it's already strike one. I mean, it's three strikes, you're out, but strike one isn't a good start.
No. You know, I want to switch gears just a bit and talk a little about the exposure that doctors have in Obamacare. You know, Obamacare has, with all of its mandates that have not yet really even been enforced or enacted, we're just now in the insurance phase of this. But once the Obamacare plan goes into full full force, there are protocols, there are directives that doctors must follow that puts medical liability directly on them, and that has certain implications as far as exposure for doctors, doesn't it?
You know, I don't even know where to begin when you deal with a bill that is 2,000 pages. There are so many places where we could talk about the increased liability. Let's start at the very beginning. I do, you know, President Obama went to the American Medical Association and made a stunning admission. He said that medical malpractice is a real issue that needs to be tackled, and defensive medicine is quite real, and it's understandable why tort reforms should be implemented. So, yeah, that was all magic to the doctor's ears, and I listened intently, fully expecting that there would at least be a few paragraphs in the 2,000-page document which would address the tort issue, because they, you know, in terms of selling the plan, and I'm not a fan of the plan, but in terms of selling the plan, I thought I heard that action can and will be taken related to the tort climate. But when the final sausage emerged, there was really nothing in it. There was a statement that the tort climate is a problem and we should study it more. That is, we should form a committee and see, you know, let the states try and play around with it, and we'll throw a few dollars, and when I say a few, I mean a few, not much at all, and see if we can come up with solutions. So years later, we've not really seen much in the way of substantive demonstration projects. But what I can say is that there does appear to be the power to promote protocols, and the subtext is that if you choose not to follow the protocols, you may be at increased liability. There's so much uncertainty in the law. The concern would be that if you don't dot every I and cross every possible T, you may be putting your life savings at risk. So I think the jury is still out, using a legal metaphor, but I wouldn't hold my breath hoping for a rosy outcome in terms of the legal climate related to the Affordable Care Act.
So obviously the problem is still out there. It still is a tremendous issue. It's a drain on the system. And so for the rest of the show, I would like to focus on some of the efforts that you've been involved with the organization Patients for Fair Compensation and the patient compensation system. So Jeff, just tell our listeners what the difference is between the medical compensation system here in the United States versus elsewhere.
So let me start with an example that I'm in favor. Well, let me start with the U.S. I can do that very quickly. In the U.S., if you are injured, you typically will find your remedy by filing a lawsuit. So the first step is the legal system is very complex. You've got to find a lawyer to propel your case. Now, a lawyer is only going to propel your case if the case is worth a lot of money. Survey was done to a collection of plaintiff attorneys asking what is the minimum amount you really need to see in damages before you'll take a case. And the answer was minimum of $250,000, but for most lawyers, they needed to see a minimum of $500,000 of damages before they'll even agree to take a case. So most cases don't rise to that level, which means that most legitimate cases never see the light of day. Next, you will have a battle of the experts on both sides. The patient, now the plaintiff, will hire an attorney and they'll hire their own experts. The defendant, the doctor who treated the patient, will hire their own experts. And they duke it out. They battle it out trying to persuade 12 laypersons that their story is the correct one, that the doctor violated some standard of care and that violation caused damages. And over 3 to 5 years, there will be an outcome. Now, once the payment is made, the lawyer has to take his cut. They typically subtract the expenses, which are generally five figures. Then they need to get their own payment, you know, which is often about 40%. So at the end of the day, a patient who actually does get a settlement or judgment, remember most do not, won't see a whole lot out of that. So they've gone 3 to 5 years, waited a long time. Doctor's gone through hell 3 to 5 years. And, you know, most patients don't collect anything. So that's the current picture. Do we have time to move into
we're coming up on a hard break in just a couple of seconds. So let's pick it up from there when we come back from break, Jeff.
Perfect.
Thank you. You're listening to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
This is Dr. Elena George with your health tip of the day. Did you know that chronic nasal congestion, a decreased sense of smell, and asthma can be signs of allergies. Allergies are caused when the body is exposed to things you breathe in or eat that the body does not like. The body's immune system reacts and attacks it, what it perceives to be the enemy, even if it causes no harm, like pet dander or dust. This leads to swelling. In the nose, this causes congestion. In the bowel, it causes stomach bloating and diarrhea. In the lung, it causes shortness of breath and wheezing. And in the skin, it causes hives and itching. The first line of defense against allergy is avoidance. Dustproofing, washing pets, and keeping them out of the bedroom can help with environmental causes. For food allergies, keeping a diary of things eaten and reaction to them is helpful. Allergy testing is less time-consuming and is a safe and effective way to identify allergies. For a complete evaluation, you should see your allergy specialist.
Hi, this is Kate Copsey, inviting you to listen year-round to America's Homegrown Veggie Show every Saturday at 10 a.m.
Watchdog is a term given an organization like the United States Justice Foundation, which since 1979 has been watching out and, when necessary, taking the appropriate action from testifying to litigating to protect our constitutional rights. USJF, a nonprofit organization, is nationally recognized not only as a watchdog, but many in the government, as well as those involved in legal cases, have also called the USJF a bulldog for the tenacious approach in their presentation and proof of what is right. Find out more at www.usjf.net. Support USJF as they support you.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
I'm back with – this is Dr. Hal Schurz back on in the Doctor's Lounge with my guest, Dr. Jeff Siegel, and we've been chatting about medical malpractice. Jeff, why don't we pick the conversation up where we left it? You were talking about how most patients with meritorious cases never get medical justice because their cases don't get to the financial minimum that most lawyers require to pick up their cases.
Yeah, that's correct. Lawyers are in business to make money. They're there to advocate for justice, their client, but they're also not going to go bankrupt in the process. So they need to make sure that there's some threshold dollar value that their case is likely to reach before they even accept the case. So the system we have in the U.S. is one that is capricious, takes a long time, and is very adversarial. Now let me contrast that with virtually every other country on the planet. And I'll use Sweden as one example. Now Sweden has a system. They've got the tort system that we have. But approximately 25, 30 years ago, maybe longer, they said it wasn't working for them. So they still have the current, you know, the system that we have. And if their new edition doesn't work, they can use our version of the tort system as a backstop. So what do they have? If a patient is injured, they go before a board. The board is a request to investigate. All the records are put together, and it's evaluated by experts in the field, namely doctors in the same specialty that were treating the patient. Now, this is done very quickly. It doesn't require an attorney. When I say quickly, we're talking about weeks. So a fair, honest, and objective evaluation is done. And the physician panel is designed to just do one thing. It's designed to see or determine was the event preventable? Could it have been avoided? And if it could have been avoided, is that what caused the patient's injury? If the answer is yes, then it moves to a compensation panel, not even a panel, it's really just a chart, and the patient receives a check. So if the answer is no, that the treatment which caused the injury was not avoidable, then the patient receives no compensation. The thing that I like about the system, and the reason most doctors and patients like the system, is A, it's not adversarial. It's not a name and blame system. It's not a cage fight to the death. It really is an honest, open evaluation looking at the truth. Next, it's quick. So a patient can receive timely compensation. They don't have to wait 3 to 5 years, having gone through bankruptcy, then finally receive the check long after they could have used it. They received compensation in a timely fashion. And because doctors can be open and honest here, it tends to promote patient safety. One of the real deficits of our current system is we have a name and blame system. So what is the natural and rational human behavior when everybody is pointing the finger at you? It's to bury what happened. But in a non-adversarial system that's not a blame and shame system, people can talk open and honestly about mistakes, learn what happened, and disseminate these lessons learned to everyone in the field. So it's a system that I am a real fan of. Sweden's is not the only system that behaves this way. You can look at Canada. You can look at most entities in Europe. In fact, you can look at virtually every country in the world, and they have some variation of this type of system. The U.S. is actually the outlier. We pay a very heavy price for trying to maintain this extremely dysfunctional system.
And why is it that we can't move to a system like the rest of the world?
That's a great question. If we were just being rational, we would jump right in and say, let's try to mimic what has been in place in other countries for decades. It's been time-tested. The people who matter most in this drama, namely the doctor and the patients, not only like that type of system, they love the type of system. And in Sweden, if you, the patient, don't like the outcome, you can use the traditional tort system as a backstop. So we could create a system like that, but there are so many powerful forces against it. What are some of those forces? Well, the trial bar is very visible and vocal in its opposition to anything that would change the jury system. They believe the jury system is sacred, that it does a great job, and that it has served our country well. And I would argue that in many cases, a jury system is a good system. In criminal cases, for example, I think the jury system is a good system. But when you start to get to extremely technical matters, and I would argue that the healthcare system is a very technical matter, it starts to go over the head of lay people. In fact, it goes over the head of many doctors. I'm a neurosurgeon by training, and for me to spend a lot of time trying to analyze the cardiac ablation of an arrhythmia, I would be a layperson at that point. I don't have any background training and experience to really understand that. So I think I'm not a fan of the jury system as it relates to healthcare. This is a long-winded way of saying that some of the forces opposed to amending or updating our system would be the trial bar. And to my surprise, actually, another opponent to changing the status quo are some of the professional liability companies, mainly because they're doing reasonably well in our current environment, being able to charge premiums and control the defense of a case, and making a profit. So insurance companies are in the business of making money. If they're currently making money, my guess is that they are opposed to change. So those are two entities that seem to be opposed to radical change that would put us on step with norms in the rest of the planet.
Aren't doctors also afraid about a system that, even though it's dysfunctional, even though it is it's costly, even though they practice defensive medicine, doesn't changing the system to something that is an unknown entity to them in many ways frighten them?
There's no doubt that there's a great deal of education that needs to occur. So the devil you know may be better than the devil you don't know. But I think that there are so many improvements that could be addressed with our system. So the devil we know right now is that it's an adversarial system. If you've never been sued, you likely will be. So there are two types of doctors, those who have been sued and those who will be. And they're going to get a taste of what the system is like. What we'd love to move to would be a system that is non-adversarial, where the doctor is not a protagonist in this drama. In fact, the doctor wouldn't even have to show up in a new system. If they wanted to fight the claim, they could do it. If they wanted to ignore the claim, they could do it. If they wanted to be an advocate and march in hand to help the patient seek compensation, they could do it. I would argue that's a much better system.
And that's the patient compensation system that you're involved with, right?
Exactly. So the patient compensation system is a radical departure from what we are currently living with. They would essentially blow up the current medical legal tort system and replace it with an administrative system. So what would that be like? If a patient is injured, they would file a request to investigate this particular case, and it would be reviewed by three doctors in the same specialty as the doctor who took care of the patient. So the chart would be redacted to make sure that there were no conflicts of interest, and their task would be to do one thing. Was there a violation of the standard of care? The answer is either yes or no. If the answer is yes, it goes to a compensation committee. And there are many ways that this could be implemented, but one way would be to just look at a chart and say that a person who is 45 that lost his arm due to a violation of standard of care would receive this amount of money. So it would be near-term predictable remedy. The current system we live with has unlimited liability. So although most lawyers will settle for policy limits of $1 million, not all will, which means that in some cases, if the doctor chooses to defend, he or she would actually be putting their entire life savings at risk. There's a case not too long ago in Georgia, where you practice, where a cardiologist saw a policeman who was young, and he was having some chest discomfort. So he was scheduled for a cardiac catheterization. I think it was a cardiac catheterization the following week. Over the weekend, he decided to engage in a menage a trois with two other people, none of whom were his wife, and had a heart attack, and he died. So the family sued, saying that the patient had not been adequately warned to avoid engaging in any type of strenuous activity. So it turns out he performed his own cardiac stress test over the weekend. And sadly, this case went to a jury and delivered a verdict for $4 million. Wow. So if the doctor were 100% liable for this case, his insurance carrier would pay the $1 million. Then he'd have to find the other $3 million to satisfy the judgment.
Wow.
In the new system, you would know precisely what the remedy is, but the doctor's financial assets would never be at risk. Doctor's financial assets would never be at risk.
Wow. And as you've said earlier, this is not necessarily even malpractice. What it is, it's the ability of the defense attorney or the plaintiff's attorney to put on a good show and to get a hired gun or an expert witness who can dazzle the jury better than the defense attorney's people can.
This is theater. This is theater backed up by legal arguments, but at the end of the day, you are hiring a professional who can communicate and sway and persuade a jury. And because you've got experts on both sides, you know, a jury often thinks, well, you know, there must be great arguments for the both. I'm going to go with the more persuasive individual. But how is a jury to know? I mean, even I would struggle in most domains of medicine, and I've been in healthcare for over 30 years.
Yeah. We're closing in on a hard break, and we'll be getting into our last segment after that. But I want you to think about, Jeff, where we're at with the patient compensation system and what efforts are being done to try to implement this in places around the country and what the likelihood of that happening is going to be and what some of the roadblocks might be to implement it. You're in the Doctor's Lounge with Dr. Hal on America's Web Radio.
Certification. Do you know why becoming a certified healthcare consumerism specialist is more important than ever in 2014? Adding this specialized designation to your credentials tells employers or your clients that you understand how much our industry has changed and how to navigate that change successfully. IHC University's certification program offers coursework both online and live at their biannual forum conference series, and testing is completed online. Reaffirm your position as a leader in the health and benefit management industry. Download our certification overview and learn more at www.theihcc.com. That's www.theihcc.com.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on americaswebradio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on americaswebradio.com anytime you like.
Do your children know where their food comes from? At ConnectingFarmToFork.com, there's all kinds of ways to help your child understand how 300 million of us here in America stay nourished, clothed, and healthy. Activities, food facts, and farm visits help young people learn about America's hardworking farmers and have lots of fun doing it. Visit ConnectingFarmToFork.com today for a learning experience that'll really grow on you. ConnectingFarmToFork.com, brought to you by the people who care at Feedstuffs Food Link.
This is americaswebradio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back to the Doctor's Lounge. So, Jeff, let's pick up what the question I asked before the break about the patient compensation system. Where are we with that, and what are some of the possibilities?
All right. So, the patient compensation system is an idea, and I think it's a great idea, and it was birthed initially by Rick Jackson of Jackson Healthcare. Why did he do it? He wanted to do it because he thought defensive medicine was such a problem in the U.S. that if we could just decrease the amount of money spent on tests that provide no value other than to keep a doctor out of the courtroom, he thought if we could redeploy those funds, it could be done for healthcare innovation, for lowering healthcare premiums. There are a million ways that money could be repatriated for better uses. So the patient compensation system was an idea that was begun, I think, or at least invented, if you will, by Rick Jackson, Jackson Healthcare. But he's also done something else. He's tried to get this implemented into law in at least two states, and we think more are around the corner. What does that entail? Well, that entails a lot of work. It entails finding legislatures that agree that the idea is a good idea and will sponsor a bill, so the statute needs to be crafted. If you're going to blow up the medical legal tort system, it needs to be done in statutory language, something that is very difficult. Anytime you make sausage, you know, it requires a lot of activity. But craft the bill, get a sponsor in the House and the Senate, and then ultimately get it passed, and then get the governor to sign it. So that's the simple version of how it gets done. The more complex version is to educate the legislatures and ultimately educate the various stakeholders, because some stakeholders will support it, some stakeholders will fight it, and that's the battle that occurs every day in legislatures across the country. And that's where we're at today. So in Georgia and Florida, the bill has been crafted, the bill to create a patient compensation system to replace our current medical legal tort system. There have been sponsors that have been found in both of those states, both in the House and the Senate. And where things have stalled, at least for the moment, is in the process of getting the stakeholders on board. Because when a legislature is trying to decide whether to vote yes or no on a statute, they do hear from their constituents, or more accurately, they hear from the lobbyists that represent the constituents. And that's the fight that's going on right now. There are a number of entities that are doing reasonably well in the status quo. Those would include the trial bar as well as the professional liability carriers, and they have been perfectly comfortable in maintaining the status quo, arguing that the devil you know is better than the devil you don't know. And that is the fight. It is an uphill struggle. Anytime you change a major system like the professional liability system, you know you're going to be in for a fight. But I would argue that it is a fight worth having. And if enough doctors and enough patients understand the benefits as well as the downsides of a new system, I think they will overwhelmingly vote in the positive for this.
Jeff, you've told us very eloquently what the upside is. What's the downside?
You know, I could fabricate some downside. I'm not sure I know what the downside is. This is a system that has been implemented in so many other countries, and they've all had the choice to say, this is a horrible system, this hasn't worked, and we're just going back to what we had previously. I don't know of one country that has actually made that leap. So it's been tested over time. Is it a radical change from what we're from what the rest of the world has been doing? Absolutely not. This has actually been time tested. The allegations from the stakeholders is that the system would be flooded with new cases, and it would implode due to extra cost. Now, I've heard that complaint, and there are two ways to address that particular argument, which is a false argument. First is that the system will be flooded with new cases. Well, it is true that more cases will be heard. Now, if the cost of those new cases isn't that great, then that's okay. That's not a bad thing. It means that more people are getting access to a just, fair, and timely remedy. We've crunched the numbers with very respectable actuarial firms, and they've basically said that the new claims that come in will be low-value claims. When I say low-value, $5,000, $10,000, $20,000, remember, the current system really does not see cases unless you can find $250,000, $500,000 in damages. So the cases that are likely to come in would be low-value claims. Number two, just in case we are mistaken about the cost, there is language in the bill that says the aggregate cost for the professional liability system cannot be greater than what we're currently spending. So the fear that that large amounts of dollars will be spent above and beyond what we're currently spending is entirely unfounded. The plain language of the statutes prevents it. And the final point I'd like to make, point three, I only said there are two points, but there's really a third point, is that a lot of the cost of the current system is based on defending a case. You've got a 3 to 5 year cage fight to the death. Somebody's got to get paid. The lawyers are getting paid to defend the case. Experts are getting paid. This stuff is not cheap. The average cost of defending a case that goes to trial is in five figures. So, I mean, it's over $100,000. This would go away completely. It would disappear. You wouldn't have these expenses. So, yeah, we can take some additional low-value claims. The cost essentially will be at no greater than what we're currently spending, and almost certainly will be lower than what we're currently spending.
Wow. Jeff, you know, this is such an incredibly complex and important topic that I think we've just scratched the surface of this whole issue, and we are winding down our hour, and I'm afraid that we're going to have to cut it right here. So I'm hoping that I can invite you back so we can get a little bit deeper into medical malpractice, the physician compensation model, and other issues around tort reform. But the last thing I'd just like to briefly ask you is, how can people learn more about this and get involved?
So there's a website called patientsforfaircompensation.org, or just Google Patients for Fair Compensation. So just Google Patients for Fair Compensation, and there's an incredible array of information out there to allow both doctors and patients to step up to the plate and get us a better system.
Jeff, thanks so much for being here today. I really enjoyed this discussion, and I hope that everybody enjoyed our chat as well.
Delight. Let's do it again.
Yes, thank you. So, again, I'd like to thank our guest, Dr. Jeff Siegel, for educating all of us about medical malpractice and potential solutions for this long-standing problem. It's been a drain on our healthcare system for decades, and as we've learned, it enriches insurance companies and lawyers at the expense of those who deserve compensation for medical injuries, the patients. And we heard the startling statistic that every doctor is likely going to be sued in their lifetime, and this is not a good thing for patients. Next week, my co-host on this show, The Doctor's Lounge, Dr. Mike Karuchik, will be behind the microphone, and he'll conclude his discussions about the problems with the electronic medical records. He got into an in-depth discussion or talk soliloquy about this on the last show, and he'll focus on the problems with security of medical records or the lack thereof. I'll be back here in the Doctor's Lounge in 2 weeks talking about Medicare, and we'll get into the history of the program and the problems facing this giant entitlement program and possible ways that we can preserve it for those who paid into this system with the belief that it would be around to provide health care for them when they were elderly. And my guest will be Dr. Richard Armstrong, a general surgeon from Michigan and the chief operating officer of Docs for Patient Care. I'd like to put a plug in for a meeting that the Docs for Patient Care Foundation, the sponsor of the Doctor's Lounge, is putting on at Steamboat, Colorado. It's the Steamboat Institute, and it's being held August 22nd to 23rd. Our keynote speaker will be Dr. Ben Carson, and he is going to discuss whatever Dr. Carson talks about, which is very captivating, and everybody really enjoys listening to his honest talk about issues in our country today. Docs for Patient Care Foundation will host a healthcare panel as part of this meeting featuring healthcare policy experts Grace Marie Turner from the Galen Institute and Sally Pipes from Pacific Research Institute, as well as some other distinguished speakers. At this meeting, which is a very intimate meeting, seating is limited, so I encourage everyone to check it out at www.steamboatinstitute.org and plan to come. I think that you'll be very glad that you did. I would like to thank David Moxley for running our board today and thank America's Web Radio for giving us the platform to discuss important healthcare issues with you. Please share the link to this show with your friends and your social media contacts at www.americaswebradio.com/ The Doctor's Lounge. And please get us some feedback at doctorslounge@americaswebradio.com. I'd love to hear from you and get ideas about how we can improve this show. I'd like to wish everyone a very happy Independence Day and remember the spirit that resulted in the founding of this great country of ours and try to recapture that spirit in yourself and actively do something to preserve the gift that those who came before us have given to us. Thank you very much, and thank you for being in the Doctor's Lounge. This is Dr. Hal Schurz.